Any closing thoughts?
Well, I mean, I hope that people in the United States understand what's happening right now in Europe, because they might be next. And traditionally, for the United States to lose Europe is very dangerous. The United States had to participate in two world wars precisely for that reason. What emerges now in Europe is a hostile structure to the United States. I believe today, the United States, with diplomacy, can do a lot to prevent it from happening, and I hope they would do that.
Yeah, except there's a very strong push here to make the same thing happen here. And most of the West has sort of sold out to the socialist model. In the United States, there's a lot more opposition to it. I'd say about 50% of the country in one form or another understands what we're headed for. But I'm not, so far, I don't see anything turning around anywhere, to be honest with you.
Well, this might kind of hopes. I hope that somehow people would understand what they're talking about and what the danger is involved in it.
Yeah, one would hope. So anyway. All right, Vladimir Bukovsky, I appreciate your time. Hopefully we can touch base from time to time.
Sure, definitely.
It was just 11 years ago in November that a member of the European Parliament, Sir James Goldsmith, testified before the U.S. Senate to the Commerce Committee there. And here's what he said. This is a quote from his testimony. "What we are witnessing is the divorce of the interests of the major corporations and the interests of society as a whole. We have
views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, good evening. This is Michael Shaw. I'm your host tonight at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio. We're going to continue our series on the War on Reason with tonight's episodes, which we're going to describe. The first hour, our guest is going to be Mr. Terry Hayfield, and we're going to talk a number of subjects. And to begin our conversation, I'm going to quote from Rose Martin in 1966. Britain's Fabian socialist movement would remain a formidable and destructive power in the future, as it had proved to be in the past. Its connections and its influence are worldwide. It has demonstrated more than once that it can be as dangerous in defeat as it is in victory. The wealth and the power of the largely unsuspecting United States is still the Fabian society's trump card. In 1997, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, the former chairman of the British Fabian Socialist Society, said, quote, "5 years ago, the Rio Summit launched Agenda 21. Since then, 70% of our local authorities have been inspired to think global, act local, through local Agenda 21. But we must do more. I want all local authorities in the UK to adopt local Agenda 21 strategies by the year 2000. Well, Agenda 21, as any regular listener to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show knows, is sustainable development. It is the official policy of the United States, or the federal government of the United States. Sustainability is the progressive program for the creation of a police state, a global police state. The strategy is to create crisis, so to create shortage, and further the feeling of crisis. And when sufficient crisis exists, our natural rights are to be replaced by human rights, or the categorization of people as biological resources. The tactic that implements the emerging sustainable police state is what's called an artificial dialectic. So tonight, we're going to talk with our guest about Fabian socialism, the nature of the dialectic, and what he calls the permanent revolution. Terry, are you with us?
Sound man, turn your end up. I can hardly hear you.
Okay, can you hear us now?
Yeah, that's better.
All right, very good. Well, I want to welcome you to our show, and I want to just introduce you by telling the audience that Terry Hayfield is one real human being. And I'm very interested and excited about our conversation tonight and what it is that after many, many years of study and research on the issues that I presented in the opening, you know so much about.
Yeah, I delved into it a little bit. Well, go on.
Well, give us a start on what it is the American populace needs to know. As we discuss here in these 4 weeks in June, the war on reason, clearly the political tactic for making that war is very sophisticated. And what's not known in the United States is how this Agenda 21 and sustainable development movement got rooted. Is there really a global political dynamic that is shaping tomorrow's world in a world very, very unfinishing to the American experience? We'll be right back here at Freedom 21. Well, we're back here with our special guest while some stations are away. Mr. Terry Hayfield, as we begin our discussion about Fabianism and how it is the political tactic is creating a transformation within the United States.
Yeah, the basic tactic is correct. It's the artificial dialectic, but there's more to it than just the artificial dialectic. Basically, you ask what Americans should be looking for, and they should be looking for what is necessary to preserve the American Republic. We have to preserve the American Republic because the American Republic protects what is most dear and the basis of our national sovereignty, and that's called the Union, the Perpetual Union. The Perpetual Union was created with the ratification of the Articles of Confederation. The Perpetual Union survived the dissolution of the Articles of Confederation and the ratification of the Constitution. It's the basis of our sovereignty. The Union is, to most people, should be known as the natural dialectic, the people being the natural dialectic and the government being the natural antithesis to the people being the thesis of the natural dialectic.
Well, explain that for a moment just to the listeners, the terms thesis.
In dialectic, there is known as thesis, antithesis, synthesis. The antithesis is a challenge to the thesis, and through an interaction between the two, you'll have a synthesis of something, whatever. There are two types of dialectic, a natural dialectic and an artificial dialectic. The natural dialectic has always existed. Man versus woman, old versus young, dog versus cat, sun versus moon, etc. Okay? The natural dialectic will always slice, eventually defeat the artificial dialectic. But enemies of the people, which what I would consider an antithesis to the natural thesis, would want to destroy the natural dialectic in order to gain control. In America, the basis of, like I said, our national sovereignty, the natural thesis is the people, the Union. And anything that's an enemy to that is antithesis. I consider myself an American patriot, and I believe in preserving the republic, so therefore I'm a right-wing extremist. Above all else, regardless of what issues are facing America, the union has to be preserved.
Okay, well, our audience is about to return with us in about 10 seconds. But basically, you're describing the dynamic of social interaction that affects in a political context.
Right.
We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and our special guest, Terry Hayfield, has explained how a dialectic operates naturally as a function of social dynamics amongst human beings. It can boil down to good versus evil, but other opposites get contrasted in a dialectic. And he's explaining the existence of artificial dialectics, that is, man-made or manufactured dialectics that can create people pitted against each other. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that's a fair summary. The artificial dialectic is a symptom of what is known as the permanent revolution. And I'd like to take a few minutes describing the permanent revolution, which is very real. Many of your listeners will be hearing this for the first time and probably won't believe it, but that won't make its existence any less real.
Well, perhaps as you begin, they should simply think back on the movie 1984 as an ultimate expression of the permanent revolution. But let's take from where we are today and describe how a permanent revolution is created.
The permanent revolution is basically a continual process of war, revolution, and terror, intended to facilitate the global proliferation of a very specific and unified Anglo-American British capitalism based on the precepts of the Fabian Society, which was founded in the 1880s. The objective is the creation of a free market economy, some people call it economic democracy, based on international free trade regulated through the United Nations General Agreements in Paris and trade, and its evolutionary offspring, the World Trade Organization.
Now, hang on for a second, because our listeners are going to have some immediate reaction to the use of some of the terms that you've done. And I just want to make a comment. You talked about the Anglo-British capitalism. I think people need to understand, firstly, that the word capitalism is a word that is used in so many contexts. And what we're talking about now is a special type of capitalism.
I'm about to come to that.
Okay.
If you hang on.
All
okay.
Right.
International free trade requires the explicit destruction of national sovereignty. The final goal is the perfection of a highly organized and technologically advanced capitalism. This capitalism will only reach its perfection when it has finally evolved into some form of socialism. Once this perfected corporate socialism dominates all global economic activity, then it will become possible to create the economic, political, social, and moral conditions to create a self-regulating classless society directed by a dictatorship over the proletariat.
Well, so that classless society is really an elite, a dictator elite, and the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Now, to go along with this, there's another facet to the permanent revolution. The permanent revolution is in front of us every day, and it's hidden from us because of rhetoric. And the rhetoric comes from what is known as perestroika, the process of creating false opposition groups in order to identify your enemy.
Now, Gorbachev would always use that term as though it was something favorable. Most Americans...
On the same line, yeah.
Okay,
they use splint groups, and they introduce a wide variety of ideologies necessary as catalysts to help facilitate the establishment of capital of American British capitalism as the only means of production on the earth.
Well, so in other words, the idea is to create conflict in order to present a solution. The solution is always advancing a political economic theory that you've characterized as American British capitalism, which has elements that we've talked on in other hours of this series, certainly the hour that has not been broadcast, but that is on the website archives, our interview with Dr. Vieira on central banking and international monetary dynamics.
Well, anyways, the Fabians realized the value of, if you can imitate the natural dialectic and replace it with an artificial dialectic, you might be able to control future outcomes, such as if you can effectively rewrite history and also rewrite the present reality for people right in front of their very eyes, you can control future events, and you do that by creating the artificial dialectic. Now, and the Fabians have been successful at this because they use two basic tactics of their own in making sure all this works. They have one practice that is known as penetration, where a Fabian himself, a member of the Fabian Society, will get actively involved in politics or business, what have you, and carry out his business to the thinking and the ways of the Fabian Society. Their other tactic is called permeation, taking a non-Fabian to get them to do Fabian bidding. Okay? So, in short, the permanent revolution is a continuous process clearing the path for the evolution of capitalism into socialism.
Can you...
It's being done by the Fabians, and they do it by penetration and permeation. And I can really give you real-life examples, and it will really shock a lot of your listeners when I start giving you the examples that I've chosen.
Well, are you ready to do that?
Oh, yeah, I am ready to do that.
Well, let's go.
Okay. Everybody, I'm sure, in your listening audience have heard of a man named David Horowitz. David Horowitz has been claims to be one of the main campaign strategists for George Bush's successes in 2000 and 2004. Am I correct?
Yes, I think most people recognize that he was a student radical on the left as a college student and is now a, I would think of him as a leading neocon.
Yes, he's a leading neocon, but he would deny that till the day is long. He would consider himself a conservative. Anyways, David Horowitz is a Fabian agent of permeation.
Meaning he's a knowing
Fabian? He's a knowing, he knows exactly what he's doing. He has a biography out that was published in 2003 called Left Illusions, with an introduction written by a gentleman named Jamie Glazoff. And on page 16, Jamie Glazoff lets us know that, and I quote, Horowitz spent the years 1964 through 1968 in London, where he worked for the philosopher Bertrand Russell's Peace Foundation.
Oh, my.
And came under the influence and tutelage of the Marxist biographer of Stalin and Trotsky, Isaac Deutscher. In this environment, Horowitz's writing career as a New Left Marxist flourished. He edited two books, Containment and Revolution and Corporations in the Cold War. And a book inspired by Deutscher, he wrote, Empire and Revolution, A Radical Interpretation of Contemporary History. Now first, Bertrand Russell was alive at that time, so it's safe to assume that David Horowitz came in contact with Bertrand Russell. There's an educational website in the United Kingdom, www.spartacus.schoolnet.co.uk, and this has a listing of a biographical listings of important people in English history, and they have a listing for Bertrand Russell. And they recognize Bertrand Russell as being a member of the Fabian Society. Also, Bertrand Russell is the man that organized the anti-draft demonstrations in England and the United States. Oddly enough, David Horowitz became the leader of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam era. Now, for 4 years, David Horowitz studies in England under Bertrand Russell, a member of the Fabian Society. Okay?
I think what we're seeing now is how permeators are trained up.
Okay.
And how the American political system is loaded with many David Horowitzes. But continue with the story on Mr. Horowitz.
Okay. Now, in the book Empire and Revolution, Horowitz gives credit to the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bertrand Russell Foundation. Not only that, a man named Harold Lasky, another Fabian, and I must mention that the Council on Foreign Relations was a creation of the Fabian Society. Now, on page...
Now, that's a documentable circumstance.
Right.
The Fabians...
They have
quite a whole number of organizations. The London School of Economics was Fabian-originated.
Oh, yes.
Not. Council on Foreign Relations.
The American Republican Party and the American Democratic Party. Oh, yes. Anyways... On the bottom of page 27, David Horowitz, when confronted about this material, will holler conspiracy and deny the existence of the permanent revolution publicly.
Well, but the permanent revolution is an idea. And
no, it's not. It's an actual event. It's
well, I understand it's an event, but it's an idea that has been eventized by the action of permeation and penetration.
Oh, yeah, that's correct. Now, let me read what David had to write. In the concept of permanent revolution, as expressed by Marx in its rudimentary form, are adumbrated all of the major elements of Bolshevik theory. The uninterrupted progress of the revolutionary development, the program of completing the merely partial emancipation of the bourgeois stage and making permanence reform. And he footnotes, talking about Bolshevik theory, and at the bottom of the page, it's footnote 24, he says, Lenin referred to uninterrupted or continuous revolution rather than permanent revolution, which had been revived as a term by a man named Parvus and Leon Trotsky. When you go over to the next page, there's another footnote. And this, David gives this quote from the Communist Manifesto. The bourgeoisie cannot long exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production and thereby the relations of production and with them the whole relations of society. Conservation of the old modes of production in unaltered form was, on the contrary, the first condition of existence for all earlier industrial classes.
Okay, so translate that for
translated, the bourgeoisie people, that is the capitalists, run the permanent revolution, and as long as they can continually increase their production and come up with new forms of production, they will remain in control of the permanent revolution.
All right,
but,
and so in order to keep that permanent revolution for what maybe is the artificial thesis, which is to have economic power continue to be more centralized increasingly as time goes along, the antithesis theoretically could be developed around issues such as the environment or social justice to lure people in. Is that true?
When Horowitz is confronted with this publicly, he completely loses control. I made him do that on a radio interview on a radio program talk show out of Omaha, Nebraska. Well, anyways, in this radio program show, I asked David Horowitz about the existence of another Fabian-created organization called the International Democrat Union, which is an international organization comprised of 70 member parties from around the world, of which the Republican Party in the United States is a member party of the International Democrat Union.
Now, for the audience, I have looked at this site, the International Democrat Union, IDU.org.
Correct.
It is definitely worth looking at, whether you're listening to this show in the United States or listening to this show in the United Kingdom, because you'll find incredibly disturbing information on this website. So go ahead and tell us about
it. The IDU was founded in March of 1983 with a gala kickoff dinner. Ronald Reagan was a keynote speaker, and by the way, if you go to look at the present publications after Reagan's death on his speeches and addresses, you'll never find this speech, because the gala never made the newspapers when this organization was put together. The International Democrat Union came up with the term compassionate conservatism. The policies of Margaret Thatcher were the forerunners to how policy was going to be envisioned by International Democrat Union politicians.
Well, and with the mention of Thatcher in the formation of the IDU, the International Democrat Union, made up of 70 political parties, including the American Republican Party and the British Conservative Party,
and
has as its stated objective the implementation of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights,
yep,
which negates natural law and substitute for it positive law. And when we hear about what the EU is doing in the context of pursuing these very same ideas, and we begin to realize that the EU model is heading toward the United States and it's also heading toward Asia, you know, we have something really to be concerned with. So go ahead, tell us some more.
Okay, now, when I asked Mr. Horowitz directly about the IDU, he immediately branded it a conspiracy. Well, the IDU has their conventions every 4 years to coincide with the Republican Party conventions to be held at the same time and in the same city.
But wait a second. How can Horowitz call it conspiracy? I saw it on the web, and there's nothing hiding here. It's in plain view.
He's hiding the permanent revolution.
Well, by denying the existence of the IDU, which is
because
so he's not telling us the truth, I suppose.
No, and he'll holler conspiracy, yell and scream, he'll shut his phone off, he'll walk off the set. I'd be willing to debate with him on this, but I don't think that would ever be possible to be arranged. It would be a problem with my end. Anyways, in 2004 in New York City, when everybody knew there was an area known as the Zone of Security in New York, where the Republican Party was meeting. And the United Nations building was within this zone of security. Well, there's a gentleman named Ted Turner, I'm sure everybody's heard about, runs an organization called the United Nations Foundation.
Well, and major media, so.
And major media. Well, Ted threw a big gala for the International Democrat Union people at the UN during the convention, and he never saw 1 second of coverage of 70 of the largest and most influential political parties around the world gather within the most secure point on the planet of the Earth, and you never hear about it.
I wonder why. Is that a trait of Fabianism?
That's a trait of Fabianism.
Well,
they control
it.
There is a bias in the media, but the bias isn't right-wing and the bias isn't left-wing. The bias that's portrayed in the media is presenting the artificial dialectic. There were demonstrators at New York, correct?
Yes.
All sorts of anti-WTO demonstrators and people from an organization called Answer. I'm quite sure there was a fair number of American Green Party people there. If David Horowitz is an agent of permeation for the Fabian Society, he's also a representative of the right-wing artificial dialectic.
And the people against the WTO, which
the artificial left wing.
Right, I'm sorry.
Okay, back when David Horowitz was writing Empire and Revolution and hanging out with the Fabians, what would become his left wing dialectic? A man named Peter Kamel, and I'm sure all your listeners are familiar with the name of Peter Kamel.
Well, for those who aren't, he was a candidate, a Green Party candidate for governor here in California, and he was. Also, he's been on the national ticket, hasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, vice presidential running mate with Ralph Nader. Now, way back in the day, back when I said about the time Empire and Revolution was written, Peter Kamel writes the introduction to a book written by Leon Trotsky entitled, other nonetheless than The Permanent Revolution.
Hmm.
And in this introduction, Kamel describes the permanent revolution, very similar to what Horowitz does, but Kamel goes a little bit farther and makes one more observation that's a very important observation that all American conservatives, especially people in the business of preserving the republic, have to hear this. Marx's prevision of a socialist society presupposed the development of a highly industrialized and mechanized production fostered by capitalism. Socialism, to be a success, has to have capitalism. Capitalism, socialism, and communism are all part and parcel of the same process. You can't be pro-capitalist and anti-socialist at the same time.
Well, let me offer my comment on what you just said. Let's be sure the audience understands that when you say capitalist, what you're talking about
is American British Fabian capitalism,
which I've characterized on this show many times as public-private partnership economics. It's where government
correct.
And certain selected compliant or otherwise more powerful business people team up with the force of government in order to take over our society.
Well, what happens there? Most of your people that are involved in public-private partnership are basically duped. They have not a clue about the existence of the permanent revolution. And they think what's taking place in America today is a natural function of the marketplace, a natural function of the American society, and it's not.
And yet, exactly, and my point there is that if we define capitalism as laissez-faire, that means free enterprise, that means, you know, private property, private liberty, private lives, that is the capitalism or the economic system that is being replaced by this Fabian dynamic that is bringing us, in their flowery words, the new public-private partnership dynamic that melds the right and the left into a world order that's based on positive law and is directed by Fabian tactics.
Well, Not necessarily. I haven't discussed, brought in the, into the discussion the concept of the flaw of capitalism. Most people don't under... If I mention the name Adam Smith, most of your listeners will say, well, this is the guy that wrote the book on capitalism. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Adam Smith really didn't write about American capitalism. Adam Smith was more than likely writing about failed British mercantilism, and he was writing what would had to been adjusted to make mercantilism work. See, mercantilism didn't work. The American Revolution is a fine example of that. Mercantilism was one of the earliest forms of capitalism. The problem with mercantilism was it just made plain too many products that the people were not able to buy. That's called overproduction and underconsumption. That's the major flaw of capitalism.
But the capitalism you're talking about is a capitalism that's based upon a money system that is
the present form.
Yes, where money is created through a central bank, and is not backed up by
anything.
Okay.
It's backed up by the people's faith in the money.
Yeah, and people's faith in the government, and if you've got Fabian ideology running your government, that's not something you want to be faithful in for very long, because Fabianism has a big, big tooth, does it not?
Oh yeah, it has a big tooth, but Fabianism dominates almost every facet of the American life, and most people don't understand that. Almost everybody that's listening to this, if you work for a living, you're almost surely working in a Fabian-controlled environment or a Fabian-developed environment.
Well, that's a very expansive statement, and one that we're going to describe more. Some stations will be breaking with us in a few seconds, but we'll continue our discussion with Terry Hayfield on the issue of the permanent revolution and Fabianism and how an artificial dialectic has been established within the United States and is being implemented through a tactic that is well known to political philosophers, but is being duped, used as a duping for the American, British, and other people around the world. We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. While some stations take a break for a few minutes, we're going to continue our discussion with Terry Hayfield. And it's a far-reaching statement, Terry, to say that every person out there who works for a living, and of course it's a moral dynamic to work for your living and to be responsible for yourself, and most people do that, and the only way that seems apparent in our society, which is to use and trade greenbacks, which are the object of I think what you're telling us has been a worldwide permeation and penetration of a political philosophy that's a bit devious.
The American workforce has basically been Sovietized. The Fabian Society developed their own brand of what is known as a worker's cell, a natural work group, employee involvement, self-directed working. The Fabians at one time thought the key to establishing a global socialism was the evolution of a unified capitalism, and all production would be collectivized and planned ahead of time, and it fizzled miserably on everybody. What failed in Russia wasn't communism. That was state capitalism. Had nothing to do with communism. Wasn't even socialism. Wasn't even a hint of socialism.
Well, and really, the Soviet Union's Russia's fall wasn't that timed along with the establishment of this British-American
capitalism. Yeah. See what happened after World War II. Similar to what happened after World War I, the Fabians finally successfully implemented a world government that included the United States of America, called the United Nations. And it was predicated on centralized planning. Even such economists as John Kenneth Galbraith supported that type of philosophy. Well, they found out it wasn't going to work at all, that they made a mistake back in their early reasonings back in, say, the 19-teens, the 1920s. And they had to correct their mistake. And to correct their mistake would require total economic reform on a global basis. And that reform was to bring back the concept of the Soviet, the workers running the means of production, instead of the state determining what was going to be run in the means of production. The workers were going to take over that responsibility. There, it's not a misnomer to call the Reagan administrations the Reagan Revolution. There are two major...
We've got our audience is returning in about 15 seconds, but what are you saying about the Reagan's administrations?
The Reagan administration implemented two basic reforms that...
We'll be right back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're back with our special guest, Terry Hayfield, discussing Fabianism, the permanent revolution, and the artificial dialectic. You know, you take those three subjects together, Terry, and it sounds to me like they're cohesive and coherent, and they do describe what we're seeing around the United States and around the world today. Of course, the money is still flowing, and most people are feeling okay, but layers and layers of our society are being peeled off. I mean, here in Santa Cruz, the dialectic that you're talking about operates from 1,000 different directions. I think we had one of those penetrators from the Fabian Society that you talked about come out from a New York university, New York City University, and came here to the University of California. And you know, he's been on the city council for 20 years. He's been here 4 or 5 times. And
does a guy's name Sir Peter Hall ever come up in discussion out there?
Well, not to my knowledge.
He used to be at UC Berkeley.
I don't know that name. I'm not tuned into that scene. So
former chairman of the Fabian Society.
Oh, really?
That after he was the chairman of Fabian Society, he went to UC Berkeley to teach economics.
Well, that's one. That's one way to do something.
And he's the brainchild that came up with the core economic unit that was going to be established during the Reagan Revolution. Was called free enterprise zones.
Yeah. Yeah, little favored spots.
And that was done through the Heritage Foundation, which is also penetrated and permeated by the Fabian Society.
Well, it just strikes me as I look over the political picture in the United States today. You can have libertarians defending genuine free speech on campus, but then they turn around and they support the WTO. So they're propelling the permanent revolution.
Most of the libertarians are agents of permeation. When you look at the Cato Institute, they're penetrated and permeated heavily by the Fabian Society's ideology.
Well, there are certainly there as anywhere a whole lot of really good people, but who are not taking and grappling with the real issues that are today, and so they're not stepping forward. Certainly Cato's done some good work here and there and on a lot of issues. I've found some of their writings to be very informative and some of them inspirational. But when you get down to the real issues of coherent, consistent, limited and moral government, they drop the ball, because the WTO support just shows a disregard for the national borders and in terms of trade policy, because it's that sort of libertarian dynamic where the global free trade, we didn't focus on the term free trade earlier, and of course what's being used in this capitalist system, this third way or fiat money-driven capitalist system, is that...
Yeah. A lot of people miss the point, and it's very, very simple. I talk about the natural dialectic and the people being the natural thesis, and I lay that responsibility and authority from the United States Constitution. I don't know how many people pick up the Constitution or even carry a copy around with them. Not a very big document, fits in your shirt pocket. But if you get out and you read Article 1, Section 8, and it delineates the powers of Congress. This, I'm going to read you the natural thesis. The Congress is speaking for the people. They're speaking for the natural thesis. Now, as I go through this, I'm quite sure the people that are listening to this radio show ought to be able to pick up real quickly the effects of the artificial dialectic. The Congress shall have the power in lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excise, pay debts, provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties and imposts and excise shall be uniform throughout the United States. To borrow money on credit, to regulate commerce with foreign nations. That's important. That's not United Nations. to establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws in the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States, to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States, to establish post office. Now you have to pay attention. To promote the progress of science and useful arts. To constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. To define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations. To declare war. We're in a war right now, we haven't declared. Grant letters of marque and reprisal. And make rules concerning captures on land and water. Is Congress controlling what's going on at Abu Ghraib? Is Congress controlling what's going on down in Gitmo? To make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. Does Congress really control the naval forces and the armies anymore? To provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. Suppress insurrection and repel invasions. Well, we do have an insurrection taking place in this country. It's been taking place for nigh on to 100 years. It's called the Permanent Revolution. It's under the control of the Fabian Society. Period. It's treasonous. Fabian policies have us involved in a war that's unconstitutional and more than likely in violation of several international wars crimes.
But
is this what America stands for? Is this what the bulk of the American people really want?
Well,
down deep?
It would appear, perhaps, that the American people are being led by
a false dialectic, because they accept a false dialectic.
But they haven't tuned in to it, although I think more and more people are. More and more people are seeing the inconsistency of the administration's position on so many things. People in Europe see the horror that the European Union will impose upon them from a political liberty perspective. And the people of Africa ought to become real concerned when Blair says that he and Bush are going to go down there and eliminate poverty. I wonder what that means under their Agenda 21 programs, which offer population control and reduction.
Well, they can try it since Margaret Thatcher's son failed in overthrowing an African nation here about a year ago, or did you know about that?
No, I did not know
about that. Oh, yes. One of the many non-governmental organization military units that are floating around the world. It seems to be all the rage. Privatization of military. I seem to remember we had a revolution over that. Quartering military troops.
Yes. Well, mercenaries. I call people around here sustainability mercenaries. But
these people are brave enough now that they can use their own private armies. That way, they have plausible denial.
And you're defining the permanent revolution as the continual process of war, revolution, and terror. Now, wasn't that really what Orwell was writing about in 1984? And didn't he have connection to Fabian types understand what they were all about?
H.G. Wells, who had left the Fabian Society because the Fabian Societies weren't radical enough. And besides that, Wells had a bad affair with Beatrice Webb and Wentz Howard.
Well, what do Fabians stand for, or what is their ultimate objective?
They are socialists, and they are for the total emancipation of all private property, and they want to turn over to the people the operation of the means of production and the civil administration of society.
Now, for folks who don't think...
But at the same time, that is their professed statement, but these people are trying to get their capitalism in a position to evolve into socialism where they will retain ownership of their private property.
And so what you're talking about is a global capitalism that then, because it's eliminated free enterprise, genuine capitalism in the minds of many people, but free enterprise...
Free enterprise and capitalism are not synonymous. They are not. If you go to Webster's Dictionary and you read the definitions, it becomes quite clear, and I'm not going to take the time to read them to you. Once you sit down and read the definitions in any standard Webster dictionary, I don't care what year, what edition, you sit down and read them, they're all basically about the same, you see the difference real quickly.
Well, I'll tell you, in the minds of the public, and some, you know, some very important writers have defined free enterprise and called it capitalism. And
but unfortunately, for the last 25 years, due to a group of people known as neoconservatives, who at one time were Trotskyites, that made the same revelations that the Fabians did in the 20s and the 30s, that collectivism wasn't going to work. There had to be something else. Then they all recognized, oh yes, Marx was right. We do have to have capitalism for socialism to be successful. And before there can be an international socialism, there first has to be an international capitalism. So what we have to do now is we have to come up with a unified capitalism the world can swallow and implement that on a global basis. Now what we're watching with the present war on terrorism is the assault on the vital third of the planet that's not under the full control of, under the full influence of American-British capitalism a la Fabian ideology, and that's the world of Islam. Because the world of Islam is totally against their law to use usury banking practices, which is the basis of American-British capitalism. You have to have paper money. You have to create more money than what you have anything to back it up, hopefully to invest it in a manufacturing or some sort of business or service that will return you more money, more paper money than what you borrowed. And that's, to their way of thinking, that's not too difficult because there's already a lot of paper money out there. But everybody's got to be playing by our rule because the paper money's got to come back to our system. We got to keep that money moving. It can't sit in anybody's hands. If it stops moving, we get into crisis. If we get into severe enough crisis, we have to implement some form of fascism, which history has already demonstrated has happened. For example, Adolf Hitler. Regardless of what everybody has been taught about how Adolf Hitler came about, Adolf Hitler, from day one, from when he was picked, to go infiltrate an unknown Socialist Workers' Party in Munich till the day he died, he was up to his eyeballs in Fabian support and help on all the way to the dear end. And that's been very well kept out of the American history books, but it's not that real difficult to document if you know exactly what you're looking for.
Well, let me ask the question, how infiltrated is the American government?
Totally.
Local levels, state levels, federal levels, totally.
Okay, I'll give you an example. You
how
talk
indoctrinated
about
are the Democrat and Republican parties?
Please? What was the question again?
How integrated is the Democrat and Republican Party?
Okay, this is easy. The artificial right-wing dialectic for the Republican Party is the International Democrat Union. There is nothing that goes through the Republican Party in the United States that doesn't adhere to International Democrat Union rules.
Well,
the Democrats, their organization, the left-wing artificial dialectic is called the Democratic Leadership Council. And the Democratic Leadership Council is affiliated with the Third Way. And the Third Way was an organization put together by, Tony Blair.
Tony Blair comes up in this analysis a whole lot, does he not?
Yeah, now people like David Horowitz will holler, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. Oh, the Fabian Society, yeah, I'll agree to you. They're left-wing socialists, but they don't have any power and influence. That dissipated at the end of World War II. And I find that very hard to believe. When you know what Fabian policies are and you can identify it when it's presented either by Democrats or Republicans, and it's not that difficult.
Well,
there's no difference between the Republicans and Democrats when you consider most of their party leaderships meet at the Council on Foreign Relations, which, again, was a creation of the Fabian Society.
So what I see locally, what I see at the state level, is the repeated circumstances of creating a crisis, creating two alternative choices, both of which end up supporting the sustainability ends. And I'm equating the sustainability process to how you've described Fabianism.
By manipulating the political artificial extremes, you force people to the political center. And that's where the Fabians want you at, because that's where their policies are at.
Okay.
By agitating the extremes, for example, I'll use the Constitution Party candidate in 2004, Peruca. If you went to their website and read it, they're talking about this dreading, coming, godless international communism. Okay? If you went to the Green Party literature, They're telling their people, oh, American and British imperialism is spreading the world over and it's taking away all our freedoms. Down with the Patriot Act. Well, they're both looking at the same enemy. They're calling them two different things because their leadership is not telling the followers the true story about who the real enemy is. And as time goes on, there's more and more people recognizing the followers in organizations are recognizing the leaders are lying to them. People are leaving the Republican and Democratic parties left and right because what they hear out of the mouths of their leaders of their parties in describing reality doesn't match what the follower is seeing as actual reality from the follower's point of view.
Okay.
Because it's run by the same people.
But most people are befuddled and would certainly not be willing to immediately accept the idea that it's a coordinated effort between the left and the right to bring to this man-made or artificial synthesis
that
we've identified as sustainable development.
Yeah, but the people on the left and the right, the followers, are not aware that it's being done by the same people. And I would venture to say a lot of the people that are operating in the artificial right and left dialectic don't know either. They're just following the trend.
Well, and that's the permeation factor you talked
about.
That's
the permeation factor, correct.
And, of course, what we see in sustainable development is that there's massive amounts of money. You know, they blur the boundaries. Of course, that's how you gather up everything. That's what the Fabians know. They know that if they can blur the boundaries of America, if they can blur the boundaries of England, if they can blur the boundaries of Europe, and they can raid all the public treasuries, and, of course, that's what the capitalist system defined as
they're
it
not,
is, with, what the fiat money
it.
Does, then they can take the riches of all the people, and that's really...
They're just not taking the state monies. They're taking the fruit of the industry of the average worker.
Well, through inflation, and we had a good
well,
session.
Well, not just through inflation. I mean, he's asking the worker is dailies when he gets off work, turns on a TV, prepare for retirement, 401k, 401k, SBG, SBG, or SBU, SBU, invest. Well, the worker does have to his 401k. Well, all that money goes into capitalist investment overseas because there's no tax on the capital gains on overseas investments. Thank you, Ronald Reagan.
Well,
and on top of that...
It certainly allows for the process of redistributing America's wealth. And that goes to the quote from Rose Martin in 1966 where she points out that the Fabian's objective is to look at the United States as, number one, their biggest challenge because they needed to overwhelm the concept of natural rights as opposed to human rights in this country, and they wanted to gather up all of our riches to be able to create their little empire on a global basis. And
they have to.
That's where we get the UN, and that's where we get Agenda 21 and the federal government's policies called sustainable development, and that's what we're seeing in our neighborhoods here, there, and everywhere as they take people out of their housing. We're going to have a good discussion in the next hour with a citizen from Great Britain telling us how people are being... Millions are planned to be moved out of their houses and into government projects that are financed privately through this global capital system. And here, even in Santa Cruz, we find people taken out of their mobile home parks and put in government housing where now things, government housing built by private enterprise or non-profit developers, and now they're living very uncomfortably. Shootings are happening, cars are being stowed away, and the government
yes.
comes in and
well,
says, well, you're going to have to get used to the rules, ladies and gentlemen.
And unfortunately, I just watched a presentation on C-SPAN by a representative from the Cato Institute saying that, hey, wait a minute, capitalism saved America when you look at it. And really, when people talk about the poor today live better than what King George III did 200 years ago. What kind of mentality is that?
Well,
of course, the guy looked like he could lose about 75 pounds.
Now, if he was from Cato, this would have been a time for Cato to tell us about the shocking United States Supreme Court case that was decided just 10 days ago on May 25th, or a month ago, on May 25th, and with little or no press coverage, the Supreme Court delivered a huge blow to freedom. Citizens are no longer entitled to reasonable due process requirements for property right cases. The case, Lingle versus Chevron, fosters sustainable development policies. In a unanimous decision, The court said it is no longer a protector of unalienable rights. Instead, it's now implemented a political economic system where rights are granted and rescinded by a ruling elite.
Thank you, Fabian.
Okay. Now, that was 9-0. No press coverage. You know, we've been building 25 years a system of solid court victories in the property rights era. And that doesn't mean that there still won't be takings, but now you've got to argue that, well, government can have any reason to restructure your property, your life, your business, your neighbor's lives, your neighbor's businesses, the whole neighborhood's business, if they can find a legitimate reason. Due process does not apply to property rights.
Doesn't sound like a more perfect union, does it?
Well, that's not operating as a more perfect union.
No,
somebody's taken the ball and thrown
that.
It away.
Yeah, we have to know about that. I want to say something about Robert Theobald, the next guest.
Yes.
I consider myself a professional revolutionary after being a patriot. And
revolutionary, you mean?
Yeah, what I say.
Revolutionary.
Yeah, I consider myself a professional revolutionary in trying to preserve the American Republic. Okay, because we have these people running around, the radical capitalist class, that have this radical idea of dissolving the union. To me, that's a rather radical idea, and I think that deserves counter-revolution. Anyways, Robert Theobald yesterday did something that all Americans that are involved in the saving the Republic business should take notice of. He and a small group of people demonstrated outside the Chatham House in England.
What's the Chatham House?
That's the home of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the original Fabian creation of the 20th century to help implement one world government.
I think they do a lot of EU work there now, too.
Yeah, well, the Fabians have control of that also. Don't forget the Fabians. Anyways, we need more people like Robert Theobald in this nation. He's got the revolutionary spirit that filled the blood of many Americans 200 years ago, and it shows back up in Mother England. He's got a very interesting story to tell. We should listen to him, because what's happening in England is going to be taking place in this country, usually in a 4 to 6 year lag, established back in the day with Margaret Thatcher and then the coming of Ronald Reagan.
So,
people should watch C-SPAN when Tony Blair is covered on C-SPAN and listen to what he has to say.
Well, the American people, we'll hear about this in the next hour, need to understand what the European Union is, because that's the plan for the hemispheric dynamic here in the United States also. The whole concept behind Fabianism, or behind the new political order that's based on principles of social justice, which equate to using the law to manipulate the people, and the economic dynamic of public-private partnerships, which is the dynamic of fascist economics, all wrapped around as
Fabian economics, not fascist economics. It's always Fabian economics.
All right,
I never lose sight of that. That when we use fascist economics, we're talking from the day of Adolf Hitler and Hjalmar Schacht and the Bank of International Settlements.
But what I'm meaning, I think I've been properly redirected here. What I'm meaning is the combination of government with business. Now the type we have today is far more sophisticated than Mussolini's, and it is Fabian. I understand that dynamic. Thank you.
Okay, and besides that, what isn't done to you at work, most people, the church you go to and the way you worship, you thank that to 100 years of Fabian manipulation with the church in America.
Well, there are some churches, I think, that have resisted, but...
Yeah, there are some. I'm talking the mainstays, like the National Council of Churches, your major denominationalists, Presbyterian, Lutheran, etc., etc. Like the President of the United States claims to be a Methodist, and he's a born-again Christian, and that God told him he should go get Saddam Hussein. Now, what was really odd, when Bush started his campaign swing in 2004, he was going to speak in Detroit, Michigan, which is roughly a 2-hour drive north from where I live. And between here and Detroit, Michigan, is a little lakeside village on Lake Erie called Marblehead. And in that Marblehead is the headquarters of the United Methodist Church that George Bush is a member of. And those people invited George Bush to come speak to their yearly gathering, and George Bush wouldn't even go to his own church to plead his own case.
Hmm. Well, once the Constitution starts to be disregarded, as it has been in so many ways. If people read the Constitution, you can look and tell quite readily that they were not living a government experience like that. And,
nope.
and it's decelerating very, very, very quickly, both at the local level and
the national level. And most Americans forget that with the Declaration of Independence, if you read that very closely, it's spelled out very specifically that when there's a long chain of abuses against the people, it is our right to throw the bums out.
Well, that's what we're going to focus on here at the Freedom 21 Conference this summer.
We need a second party.
We need a second party because we've only got one party, and the party needs to stand on the visions that was the original American vision. And that's going to be an exciting thing as America starts to wake up and struggle back into what it is that this nation can be. And Terry, I want to thank you very much for being
one other
guest.
Thing. Anybody that wants transcripts, I'm more than willing to provide transcripts, or not transcripts, but documentation of information from the program.
Well, and they can reach you how?
Through our
website, would that be the best?
Yeah, I can do that.
Okay, so you can contact us at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz either by phone, 831-684-2232, or at our website you can contact us, freedom21santacruz.net. And hang on, we're going to be back for our second hour with Robert Thorbald. And again, thank you very much, Terry, for all the research and all the consideration of what's right and wrong.
There's a real revolution going on around you. Open up your eyes.
And fusion's going to happen.
Yep.
And we'll look forward to that and talking.
Views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome back to our second hour at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. And we're going to continue to talk on subjects of Fabianism and regionalizing England in this circumstance, and the European Union, with a special guest that we've contacted in England. We're going to compare England with the United States, how the governmental systems are working there to break the boundaries of historic English life. They're raiding the treasury there just as they are here, and they're changing the law and customs of the British society very rapidly. The new world is coming quickly. Now, we quoted Tony Blair's statement last year that all authorities must in the UK adopt local Agenda 21 strategies by the year 2000. We're going to talk some tonight about how Agenda 21 has moved very quickly in England. We can expect the same patterns to follow here. And of course, I, as I've explained to the audience before, I was a actual participant in the Santa Cruz County Local Agenda 21 meetings back in the 90s. They were very, very bizarre meetings that called for a complete transformation of society, and I think we can see that that process is beginning to roll right out. So while we discuss a global transformation, it's certainly appropriate to compare notes with what's happening and how the good people in America's mother country, England, are faring. And so I'm going to welcome our guest tonight, Englishman Robert Theobald. Robert, are you with us?
Yes, hello, Michael. Thank you. Yes, I'm here.
Well, it's good to hear you. It's the sun has just gone down here in California, and I guess it hasn't quite come to rise.
It's been up for an hour here.
Oh, it's been up for an hour.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
Well, it's early there, and it's getting later here, but it's wonderful to have you on the phone.
Thank you, Michael.
Tell us a bit. Now you're with a group called One England, and
One England is actually the name of a group of people that are campaigning against regionalisation, the cutting up of England into these artificial regions. That's the name that we gave to our group. In fact, that's our website, oneengland.com.
Okay, and the campaign for an independent Britain. Tell us.
That's the sort of mother group that I belong to. In fact, I'm on the committee of that group, and we've got around 2,500 members all over Britain.
Wow.
And farther afield as well, but. One of the things that we campaign against is the regionalization of the country.
What do you mean by regionalization?
What effect does it have for the person who's rather new
to the subject?
Well, it's a very it's been done with a great deal of skill, if you like, by our opposition. For example, the first manifestations of it that you saw were the separation of Scotland and Northern Ireland and Wales, and they were the first ones. Now, they had referenda in Wales and Scotland for these for a regional government, if you like. It wouldn't be a government that covered everything, but a great deal of their affairs would be dealt with by this regional assembly.
Okay, so regional assemblies come into place and take authority over this, that, or something else.
It's
outside the scope of traditional government.
Oh yes, it's a different animal altogether. It's in Wales actually the assembly there was voted for. They got a small majority for an assembly. But only on a very small turnout of the public. If I remember rightly, it's only about 40% of the people voted. So just over 50% of them wanted it. So therefore, you've got just over 20% of people actually voted for this assembly.
Well, it sounds, if I'm to compare here and watch the regional organizations that begin to crop up over air, over water, over garbage, over neighborhood associations, over watersheds, over this, over that, and everything, what I find is that they just set them up, or they'll use democracy if they think they can win the election. And, of course, there's a lot of misinformation that's given in the context of that election, but then even when they lose the election, they still find a way to do it anyhow. It's as though a new regionalized system, both here in the United States and apparently in England, is just being ordained by the political leaders of either the right or the left.
Oh yes, the way that the whole thing is advanced is quite amazing. For example, they try to get an elected assembly here in the east of England, and we really got an unelected assembly, which is meant to scrutinise the east of England Development Agency, if you like. Really got the unelected one, but they wanted it elected. You see, now because that is the instructions from Brussels. Actually, that's the diktat that it should be elected. Now,
so when you say Brussels, you're talking about directives on regionalizations that come from the European Union.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, they wanted to have the thing elected, so that the Eastern Regional Assembly elected. So they went through this consultation process, and needless to say, only a few thousand people voted in it, or even bothered to vote out of millions and millions. I think the population of the East of England is about, I don't know, but I think it's about 5 or 6 million. But only a few thousand of those bothered to vote. And only a tiny fraction of those people actually were in favour of the elected assembly. But the way they fixed it, when they published the results, they said that anybody that had even replied to this consultation process, even if you replied and you hadn't actually been in favour, they counted that as an interest in the regional in an elected regional assembly. So all the time they're figuring out ways to advance their project, even though it's opposed by the people.
Wow. And it's the concept again of continental government that is driving the regionalization to break down the nationality of
the idea is to break down your sense of nation. And this is bizarre, actually. They go to now about a year ago, I think it was, and you can see this correspondence on the One England website. You can see it. The celebrities in our area in the East of England, out of the blue, they received a letter from the regional assembly asking them to be an East England ambassador, in inverted commas, you see. In other words, to go in the press, go in the media, and try to build up this identity of the East of England. And they've already done it. I tell you, they already had a bit of success. Professor Stephen Hawking, the Cambridge, the Lucasian professor of physics, that wrote the book A Brief History of Time, they actually got him into it, and I'm sure he wasn't sure what he was doing really, but he was brought into that sort of propaganda exercise, and Frederick Forsyth got a letter from them, and you can see Frederick Forsyth reply to the East of England Regional Assembly. It's quite amusing, actually, and if you go into One England, you should see it there. But that's one of the things they do, and all the time they're trying to create an identity when there isn't really one at all.
Yes. And the methodology then for regionalizing the United Kingdom is, let's even focus more specifically on England. You have counties.
We do.
Like we do.
Yeah.
What is the effect of the process of European integration on county governments or on the national government itself?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting one, Michael, because we always had the county. Previously, we had the city councils, which would be for the big cities. We had the county councils, town councils, and then district councils within the county, and even down to parish council, which didn't have a lot of power. But anyway, that's the structure.
And these were elected agencies that had
certain
limitations on their powers.
That's right. Yeah. And then the new system is what we call the unitary authority. Now, a unitary authority, for example, my town, I live in Luton in Bedfordshire, now that's a unitary authority, which has now got a great deal of extra power over many, many different things. This is the European Union concept. Now, the counties basically are on a slippery slope. They're gradually losing their raison d'etre, if you like.
Now, is that happening because the people in the counties want to get rid of their government? Is that happening because the parliament wants to get rid of it? Is it happening because Blair wants to get rid of it? Or is it some other force?
None of the people are very, very attached to their counties, actually. It's just that the regional government, this new regional thing, it's all the time it's eroding the county. A county now becomes, or the rump of different counties, become sub-regions of the East of England region, you see. It's a sub-region. It even has a number, you know, like, for example, Norfolk is UKH. They actually give it a letter. That's something out of science fiction, you know. That's the old county of Norfolk, you see. Another thing, of course, for example, the fire services, they want to, this is a big argument, a big struggle we've got at the moment. In our county, in our area, there's six fire control centres. That's one for each county. But in the new regional way of doing things, they want to do away with all that and just have one regional control center.
Well, and that's what's happening in America, just to compare the notes. In my county, the goal is to make an integrated water plan that covers multiple counties. And so that parallels that. And at the state level, Arnold Schwarzenegger has called for the elimination of California counties. Now, most Californians don't know that, but it's in his 2,500-page, CPR, California, performance review, and 2,500 pages that include the restructure and further regionalization of California and the elimination of counties. Now, that's exactly what the EU is requiring of Britain if the EU was to predominate, and of course they're not going to give up until they've succeeded unless the American people or the British people just say no.
I think that's right, but it's such an insidious process then. Because, for example, we've got this East of England Regional Assembly, and I'll just tell you a little bit about that, because you can, that will give you some sort of an idea for all of them. East of England Regional Assembly has representatives on there. Each authority can pay a subscription and then go into the Regional Assembly. Now, the members that go in there, they're not elected, but you do get some kind of representation, apparently, because the regional assembly is now the ultimate source of what they call the spatial planning. Okay, spatial planning, that's a word we never had before, spatial, because it translates directly from the German word Raum, R-A-U-M, which is, it comes from Hitler used to use that word, the Lebensraum, realm, if you remember that.
Well, I
don't. So the regional assembly is responsible for this, the complete planning of the whole area. That's where the houses will be built, roads, airports, ports, waste disposal, wind farms, this is a new thing they're coming up with. They're responsible for all that, and they will decree what's going to happen.
And when you say responsible for that, that means they're the governmental agency,
responsible for
putting the contracts together with the people of their choosing to create those services outside the realm of any kind of free market, genuine free market, or free enterprise system.
It's a much more dictatorial system than we ever had before, Michael.
Okay, well, it's changing the economic framework from free enterprise to a public-private partnership. And our last guest, Terry Hayfield, called those public-private partnership dynamics not fascist economics. He called them Fabian economics. And I think he makes a compelling case that it really is a new and very sophisticated wrinkle. Of course, the newness of Fabians is not. I mean, the Fabians go back to the 1880s, and they come up today with some real strength and power, as you certainly have to be experiencing in England with your Prime Minister Tony Blair having been a former chairman of the British Fabian Socialist Society. So it's not as though they don't have influence, which is they like to pretend, because if the public's eyes, whether it was the British public or the American public's eyes, was on the philosophy and the tactics of the Fabians, we'd wake up quickly and we'd suddenly sever ourselves from the leadership that we have, whether it's the Labor Party or in the Conservative Party or the Democrat Party and the Republican Party. They all seem to be working toward the same transformational end, that is, regionalize our population so that the boundaries are blurred, raid our treasuries with Federal Reserve notes, and create massive debts, and institute a new form of government to go along with their new form of economics, as they institute a new form of justice, which breaks away from English common law and breaks away from the natural law that provides the foundation for American jurisprudence, at least up till this point in time. Yes. It seems to me the parallels are quite overwhelming between what's happening in England and what's happening here in the United States.
Well, I'm talking about law, Michael. We've got this... it's been on the table for some time now. This is what they call the corpus juris. That's the, I believe it translates in Latin as the body of law, and that is the European Union law, if you like. And it's the end of our common law. But as usual in these matters, they don't do it all of a sudden, Michael. You don't wake up suddenly one day and there you have the corpus juris in place of your traditional law. They wouldn't do that because that would be too blatant. They have to chip away at your law bit by bit and change it so that they hope that the ordinary people don't notice what they've done. But these are some of the things that we've got to be worried about. That's the corpus juris means an end to the presumption of innocence.
Wow, now wait, that's coming from the EU?
Yeah. If accused, it'd be up to you to prove yourself innocent.
Well, that is the end of the era of reason, because the whole concept of reason was predicated on the idea of a presumption of innocence. I mean, otherwise, we're in a world upside down where rulers rule and the rest of us are just subjects. Yeah.
It's for you to prove your innocence. It's not for the state to prove you guilty, and then obviously an end to the right to trial by jury.
My.
Now, in jury trial, they're already attacking jury trial all the time here. Now, one of the ones just very recently, one of the very recent attacks on it, they're saying that in these financial cases, these financial fraud cases, they'll say, now, these cases are too complicated for ordinary people to understand. Therefore, we're proposing that there won't be trial by jury in these cases. So that's how they're starting.
Are these criminal trials or civil trials you're talking about?
This is a criminal trial.
A criminal trial where they make it so complicated that ordinary people can't tell the difference between good and evil? I don't quite understand that. That's convoluted.
That's what they've got on the table right now.
From the European Union.
Yeah, it all stems from that, yes.
Now, is this the same concept that the French people voted down?
The French people have always had they've had the Napoleonic law, which is what this basically is, since the time of Napoleon. They've had that. The jury trial is very, very little used in France. It's not customary to have trial by jury. And it hasn't been for a long, long time.
Well, but I've always said about that the rest of the world has a standard to look up to, and I've always been inclined to think that standard is the American standard of justice, and built on the foundation that English people created for us back to the early part of the last millennium. And if that goes away, if we lose our jurisprudence of English common law and post-Declaration of Independence law here in the United States, if we lose that foundation, then there's no standard to which the rest of the world must hold, and that Napoleonic law application could become very, very troublesome indeed for citizens all around the world.
Oh, yes, this is the law of a controlling elite, isn't it?
Well, it is.
Another aspect of it is the end to habeas corpus.
end habeas corpus?
Yeah, yeah.
British habeas corpus? You've got to be charged with a crime before you can be held? You'd be gone under the European Union if England joined the European Union, and Tony Blair wants you to do that?
Well, the police would no longer have to bring you before a court within 48 hours of your arrest if we had the full corpus juris, which is the aim, actually. And the other big thing, of course, is an end to the ban on double jeopardy, where at the moment, if you've been tried and found innocent, that's it, that's the end of the matter. But they don't want to change that so that they can try you again, you see.
Well, you know, for Americans who don't remember that part of history, that part of the Bill of Rights was easy for us to do because we just copied the British law, which had been held for hundreds of years. So the new world under the European Union or the United Nations or whatever other regionalizing organizations you want to look at would take us back, and all of these citizen protecting notions that have evolved out of England over hundreds of years.
That's right. Well, you've got exactly the same thing, and you revere it over there. It basically, in our systems, everything is legal unless there's a law to say otherwise. On the continent, everything is illegal unless there's a law to say that you can do it. It's the total opposite to what the United States and England have got.
My. Well, I do recall the analysis of Fabianism, that the objective was England and the big cherry, the United States, because if you can control those two societies, political and legal systems, you can it's easy to control the rest of the world because the other peoples are already used to a system of law that can be used against them very readily. And of course, if freedom falls tyranny will rise to be a much bigger monster everywhere, because they're not going to counterbalance it.
It will. Just the day before yesterday, actually, we were having a demonstration outside Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which you probably know has baby and root. And there was one gentleman who was a delegate there from Latvia, and we were talking to him, and he said, "What a wonderful country this is," he said, that you can stand out here in the street and demonstrate, you see. Now, we're in danger of losing that, Michael.
In danger of losing that. Yeah. Well, it's about time then that the British people started standing out in front of the Chatham House. Where are the English people? I mean, we certainly hear nothing in the press about what the European Union really is all about, or about what attitudes toward the European Union are. We certainly know that the White House and that the Prime Minister of England both are very supportive of the mm-hmm. European Union. What about the British people? How are they speaking out? How are they reacting? What do you think is going to happen on this globalizing regionalism that's
well, the English people, they've got a very strong sense of identity, Michael. In spite of everything that's been thrown at them, they've still got a great deal of identity. In actual fact, a strange thing. If you'd have come to Great Britain 10 years ago, you would see some Union flags, the Union Jack that everyone knows. You wouldn't see that many. But if you come to England today, you will be amazed at how many St George flags you see, the Cross of St George, which is the flag of England. It's almost as if the people have reacted against what's happening, and they've brought their St George flags out. And you will see them everywhere now. And when, for example, if we ever do a demonstration or anything, and we have our Union flag and our St George flag, you will get all the taxi drivers, you'll get the lorry drivers, they'll all be hooting and honking in support whenever you do that. So we've got a very strong identity, you know, even with in face of all this with this Fabian socialism that we've had, that we're having thrown at us.
Well, of course, from our last hour, to really understand Fabianism is to understand that the methodology that they are utilizing to achieve their global corporate socialist goal is a global capitalism. And we're not talking about free enterprise here. We're talking about public-private partnerships,
yeah,
taking control of all the regions of the world, never mind national boundaries. And, of course, that's what the European Union was originally designed to do, was to be this economic pact that basically began the taking down of national borders, because you couldn't decide your own trade policy without getting it blessed off by the European Union. This has been the case for some while. And I think the United States is now finding out that through the World Trade Organization, which acts like the European Union in this regard, through the World Trade Organization, we're losing control over our boundaries. You know, when trade isn't determined by a nation, then a nation begins to cease to exist. That is the way you break the boundary in order to gather the riches. And England is a long ways toward that, and that hasn't proven to work well for the people in England, and the people in America aren't faring well either under these so-called free trade international provisions, which aren't free trade at all. They're managed trade through central agencies, central governing agencies, world governing agencies like the European Union and the United Nations and World Trade Organization. So it's a challenge, I'm sure, in England, because it's certainly being a challenge here in the United States for that word to get out, because the press is so consolidated and so quiet on these issues. All we hear about is Michael Jackson and the latest missing person stories on our newscasts, and that doesn't take us quickly down the road to the understanding we need to establish a life that's our own, whether you're living in England or living in the United States and ultimately living anywhere else in the world. When we come back, we want to talk a little bit about the Pathfinder dynamic in England. I think this is something that Americans will find shocking and interesting when they look at their own communities and see that we're beginning the same process that Tony Blair has called the Pathfinder dynamic. But in the meantime, I'm welcome you to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, and I encourage you to check out our guide, easy-to-read guide, Understanding Sustainable Development, Agenda 21, a guide for public officials. You can get that at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz website.
Policies, procedures, and laws enacted by local government and non-government organizations in the name of diversity, community, and Earth are diminishing individual liberty, degrading ecology, and threatening human life and happiness in towns across the nation. You've likely already experienced some of the consequences of policies that are approaching full implementation, with little public discourse or voter input. Have you experienced any of the following? Restricted freedom of mobility as you sit for hours in gridlock traffic. Mounting limitations on, or even loss of, your private property. An engineered housing crisis that you're being told must be solved with your money by those who caused it. Loss of parental authority to a government education system that seems to emphasize social indoctrination over education. Transitioning of water resources to regional control by non-elected bureaucrats with subsequent engineered shortages. Heavy influence of international and non-government organizations over local policy, at the expense of representative democracy. You're not alone in recognizing these and other symptoms of our diminishing freedoms. The adverse consequences of collectivist policies and laws enacted by local government bodies are affecting almost every citizen in your town. Many have noticed and are ready to act to advance individual liberty, family autonomy, a vibrant ecology, and a strong economy. They're doing this by turning their individual initiative into local action for national impact. To find out how you can join others to advance freedom, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. That's freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Welcome back here to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. Some stations haven't rejoined us, but let's pick up with our conversation with Robert Theobald of England, talking about the European Union, regionalization in England, and the association of the Fabian ideology in making these things happen. In dealing with Pathfinder, Robert, give an overview of what the Pathfinder program is.
Well, the Pathfinder program, Michael, is mainly in the north of England, actually. Well, as far as I can ascertain at the moment. But the name, I think there's a clue in the name, Michael. The name gives you the clue. This is just the way to something bigger. Now, we've recently had it in...
Hold on for 1 second here. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm here with our special guest, Robert Theobald. And we're talking about the Pathfinder program in England, which, as he suggests, suggests something quite big as we're going to find the path. And just what is it that we're supposed to find to the Tony Blair Pathfinder program?
Hello, Michael?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, Pathfinder. Well, it seems to surface very, very quickly, but actually, like all these things, it's been cooking a bit longer than that. Now in Liverpool, they've just started to knock down parts of the old city. These are Victorian houses, and I believe in Liverpool. I was speaking to a friend from Liverpool, and I believe they've got plans to knock down 20,000 old houses in Liverpool area.
Knock down 20,000 houses and do what with the occupants?
Well, that's the question. There was a recent radio program on Radio 4, which I think actually I sent to you.
But
King seems to be running the most authoritarian way. They basically those organising the Pathfinder have resolved which areas they're going to knock down, and they will do everything they can to knock those places, to knock those old houses down, and it's largely an arbitrary thing. Admittedly, there are some properties that are decrepit and in poor condition, but there's also many well maintained, very comfortable, pleasant homes. You see,
well, of course, even a home that's not well maintained is still somebody's home.
That's
right. And my understanding is that 3.4 million homes have been declared to require demolishment in order to, quote, cut global warming.
Yeah.
So this is the reason for knocking these homes down and moving them into privately financed government housing. That means public-private partnerships again, where the government chooses a house builder and they build subject to the government's new green or sustainable building requirements. And then people move in and live under very heavy government-imposed rules. That's condition for the public-private partnership, is that government gets heavy controls on the rules for which people live there. And so planning to knock down 3.4 million British homes.
That's right.
In order to put them in this, New World Order housing along rail tracks.
That's right, yeah. What they say, one of the things they say, Michael, is that, oh yes, we can't keep these old houses because they're only a single skin. They're not a cavity wall construction, you say. But of course, some of our finest houses here are only single skin. For example, Buckingham Palace and 10 Downing Street are only single skin. But with the modern materials that you've got today available, you can make a very, very fine job of bringing those old houses up to scratch. You know, you've got all the latest materials and techniques, and they can be made very, very, very habitable, very beautiful. And you can cut down on heat lobster insulation and so forth. There's lots of things you can do with those old houses.
Well, and just the thought that the government would take on this kind of expense when the English budget is not much improved from the U.S. budget in terms of the kind of debt and deficits that are being set up.
Yeah.
And so we're blurring the boundaries through regionalization here and there, and we're raiding the public treasury in order to create this government housing where people will live under the thumb of regional government agencies and the rules and conditions that are placed on occupants in these places. And I say, holy smokes, is this a world we really want to put our children into? They talk about saving salamanders for future generations, and I think our focus needs to change, because if this is what's happening in free England, okay, under British rule, and we see the same patterns here in the United States. In fact, we've had the same kind of housing dynamic presented here in the county of Santa Cruz, where people's homes are demolished, they're then rounded into these non-profit housing developments that are partners between the inside developers and the government, and the rules are just atrocious. It's even making the newspaper how uncomfortable a living situation this is for the people who are living there. And the people who run the projects just say, well, people must follow the rules. And this is the world of transformation that we're going into, and we're seeing the pattern with the Pathfinder program in England and the sustainable programs generally here in the United States. Something for everybody to become aware of and to realize that this isn't just a Santa Cruz phenomenon. You know, it's not just a West Coast phenomenon. It's not just an American phenomenon. It's expanded at least to England, and we happen to suspect it goes a lot further than that.
Well, we're just at the beginning of... there's not too much understanding here, Michael, of what is meant by sustainable development, because I'll just pull up a little quotation that I've got from the regional planning document I'm just putting it up on my computer now. This was about a year or so ago, the draft report for the East of England Regional Plan, and you're going to like the quotation that I give you. It's about sustainability, and I'm just going to try and get this. I just want to give it to you. Right here. This is directly off the East of England draft planning document. Some policies include reference to the term sustainable in a fairly loose way. We would advise against using this term within policy text, as it is often unclear what is meant by this in the context of the proposals in a policy. Sustainability is a relative term, not an absolute one, as our understanding of it is imperfect.
Wow, now where did that quote come from?
It comes from the East of England draft plan. The document is actually the title of the document is RPG 14.
Well, now, is this a regionalist plan?
Yeah, that is. Yeah, that's the East of England Regional Assembly Planning Panel that's prepared that document. There's about four members on that.
Well, of course, if they have engaged in a regional plan with directives coming from Brussels, they are part of the global sustainable movement, even though they may try to step away from the language. Here in America, the language is beginning to catch on, you know, so thoroughly that they're going to have a hard time backing away from it, because clearly that quote does summarize exactly what is the case with sustainability. It happens to be whatever it is that the ruling elite or the ruling edict happens to make it be. And some of the people at the local levels are merely acting as agents for these higher tier councils, but they get their little bidding for their own political dynamics and purposes by progressing the sustainable concept. And so there's political capital that associates with it, and it's so sad to see this accumulation of personal power to either gain grants or gain political capital by furthering this regionalization, this so-called sustainability concept, which has a plan for the entire world to control the resources, to control the parenting, to control the the education of children and to control people and ultimately to reduce our numbers, because at the core of all of this is the idea that people are harmful to the earth. And of course, that's about as unreasoned as you can get. And the only time people are harmful to the earth is when they're put in the kind of tyranny that this kind of control inevitably leads to. So it's a free world, that's a clean world, that's a healthy world and a happy world, and that's the world that the genuine British American experience wants to target. That's what the ordinary people in England and the ordinary people in America by huge numbers desires for themselves and their children and the posterity. But we've been fooled by this Fabian left-right dialectic that gets us in this constant state of confusion and this constant state of division, so that we go step by step, heading downward, downward, downward into their made-up synthesis, which they call sustainability, and which Al Gore said would be a wrenching transformation of America. Now, he's a big proponent of it. He calls it a wrenching transformation. So what is it we're doing? We're running around to try to get a seat at their shrinking table while all our fellow citizens fall off the back of the wagon. And they fall off the back of the wagon because opportunity is limited when controls like what the European Union wants to do to the people in Great Britain would do to you. And it's really what it is that the Republican and Democratic administrations for the last 20 years here in the United States have been doing with our people. It was even Governor Ronald Reagan who said, California needs to change from the horse and buggy era of political boundaries. He said, we must regionalize this state. Well, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger that wants to bring that into play. But I think Californians are going to react much like Englanders do. The idea of states is important in the United States. Not as important as it ought to be, but it's still vested into the spirit of the American people. And clearly when the globalization efforts to combine the Americas, northern and southern hemispheres, starting with the northern hemisphere, when that really gets in the push, as the European Union has been in the push, I think Americans are really going to stand up. But the more we know now, the better we are, and the easier the transition, which is why it's so important that the word that we help to try to get out here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is picked up and spread all around.
I think what's really important, Michael, is that people in America learn from what's happening in Europe. Because we're farther down the road than you in many ways. And I'm so pleased that over the last few months that we've got in contact with, contact with Dr. Stan, who I believe is very close to you.
Yes.
And Dr. Stan Monteith, and now you. And I'm so pleased that we've done that, because you've done a lot of work on the state sustainability, and you've produced that very, very good booklet, the Agenda 21 Sustainable Development booklet. We've got some of those. We've already sent them out. There's not much, as from that quotation, you know, there's not much knowledge of what it actually means. And just yesterday, I got a copy of a letter which I've sent to you, actually. I faxed it to you. We've actually got one of those booklets to Michael Howard. He's the leader of the opposition in the Parliament, and we got one of those presented to him personally, and he sent a letter of acknowledgement for it. So we're getting those books out, and we're widening our knowledge of what that really means. But I think the thing that we can tell you is what's happened here with the attacks on our state, on our nation, and continuing attacks. I think it's so important for us to network with you.
Well, we will continue to do so, and we have a whole big box of more guides being shipped out to you. And if you're listening in America and you haven't seen the Guide to Understanding Sustainable Development, you really need to. You can see it on the web, and you can order them in bulk at reasonable prices from us, so that you can circulate them in your community, circulate them to your leaders, because most of the American leaders don't want to join into this program that's going to undo the American experience and leave the world in a state of Napoleon-style style type law. I mean, that's what all this is about. And when the United States Supreme Court makes the kind of ruling that I described earlier tonight in the first hour, you can look at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz website if you want to see more information, read more information about this enormously important case from the United States Supreme Court that unanimously relegates private property to the status of a poor relation when it comes to protecting American citizen rights. And this is a case decided unanimously, not covered in the press, and really is just a shocking decision. But it evidences the trend that we're seeing in the governments around the world to join in to this breaching of boundaries, raiding of treasury, and the failure to protect the rights of the citizen. And in America, if that falls away, that has just horrible consequences for the world and for the future. And, you know, we're hanging by a thread, but we're still hanging. And as Tom DeWeese will talk about at the Reno Convention conference on July 14th through 16th, there is one way we're going to be able to resurrect the American spirit, and that is precinct by precinct. And again, that's why you need to get these guides. So in your precinct, you've got some people who understand what's really happening, because this knowledge is power. You know, if we know what we're fighting and we know how they organize, there's all kinds of weaknesses there. And by sharing the information, as Robert suggests, between the U.S. and the U.K., you know, we can begin to more fully identify the pattern that's coming. Talk to me about the nature of the laws that are coming down in England, where they come from, and how they're being organized.
Well, you know what, Michael, if you go into the House of Commons and you look up at the TV monitors, which are there all the time, you've got one for the you've got one for the House of Commons, one for the House of Lords. If you look up at the monitors for the House of Commons, you will see so often on that monitor that it's a law, that they're discussing a law that's come down from Brussels, and they have to discuss it and go through the motions of agreeing it, of endorsing it. You see, now about at least 60% of the laws that are passed now are straight from Brussels.
Wow!
And then they pass them through the Parliament. And sometimes they do what we call gold plating here. So they take a Brussels law, and then they even add a bit more into it. You see, gold plating. So
your law is originating in Brussels.
Yeah, the majority of it comes from over there. Yes, that's right. But they'll never tell you that. I mean, the politicians will never say, oh yes, we're just endorsing such and such law that's come down from Brussels. Oh, no, they don't say that, because they still want to keep drawing their full stipends and wages and so forth, you know. But so they never tell the ordinary people where all this legislation comes from.
Wow. Well, it reminds me of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz's Joan Peros, geopolitical journalist who attended the Sustainable Conference, the UN Sustainable Conference in South Africa here 3 years ago. And she came back and said she saw the prototype legislation coming out of the UN environmental committees that then she immediately saw here in the state of California. So it's amazing how these global organizations are writing the laws for England, they're writing the laws for California, and certainly writing the laws for Washington D.C. And so that's another parallel that is largely unknown by the American or British people.
There's a couple of books that I'd like to mention, Michael, while I'm on the air with you. One is a book which was actually printed in 1964 in Australia, and it's The Fabian Socialist Contribution to the Communist Advance by Eric Butler.
Mm.
Now, that is a book that's full of information about the things that we're talking about, and you can get it from Donald Martin, and I'll give you his phone number in England. It's 44-1787-376-374. that's a really important one. It's just not a long book. It's only got about 60 pages, really. But so full of information, and it's really, although it was 1964, it's bang up. It's very appropriate. The other book that I've just got is by a Frenchman, and that's a fantastic book to look out for. It's Pierre de Villemarest. That's Villemarest. Facts and Chronicles Denied to the Public. I don't know if it's available in the United States. I don't think so. The publisher is Aquilion. If you go into the Aquilion website, which is Aquilion, if you go into that website, I'm sure you'll see how to get that book. But I'll tell you, from that book, Mr. Villemarest is telling us about how the Fabians were directly involved in the foundation of this European superstate, because you had Sidney and Beatrice Webb, associate of George Bernard Shaw. Then you had Eleanor Marx, one of Karl Marx's daughters, who went over to the United States to establish groups over there. You had Edward Bernstein, who is a German, I believe, and he was the main mover and shaper in Fabian cells in the heart of the German social democracy. He went over to Germany, and then the others went over to Hamburg, Brussels, Rome, Paris. And one of the main characters in the formation of United Europe is this man called Count Richard Coudenhove Kalagi. He's got a difficult name, but Coudenhove-Kalergi. That's Coudenhove Kalergi. He was the founder of the Pan-European movement, which of course gives birth to, eventually, to the European Union. Now he's directly associated with the Fabians. So Mr. De Villemarest talks about that in his book, and it's got so much useful information in there about that. The London School of Economics being a Fabian creation as well. I think that's a very interesting one for people to try and get hold of.
Well, and I would recommend, since we're talking about books, Fabian Freeway by Rose Martin, a 1966 book that reads like the most exciting novel. Every page could be a movie, I'd say, and yet when you realize that this is a documentary, it's a record, it is chilling at the same time. So the key to Fabianism is to, as the local Republican operative said, well, we can't talk about Agenda 21. We know it's there, but if we talked about it, well, we might lose an election. Well, I don't know why they'd lose an election, because when you tell the truth, you're likely to be elected. The truth is that Fabianism has to hide in the shadows, because when the light comes on it evaporates like the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz. And so that's why an increased focus, an increased understanding on Fabian ideology and its mechanisms, creating this artificial dialectic, are so important for more Americans to begin to understand. And of course, if you want to understand it, don't spend $200,000 to go and get a college degree, because you won't learn about it there, that's for sure. Well, we have a few minutes left here, Robert. What would you like to leave us with in these last couple minutes as we wrap up the hour, and on a great end of the day for us, and a good start of the day for you?
Well, I think that for me, Michael, I think that the English-speaking peoples in throughout the world, we've always been very, very attached to our freedom, and that's here and in the United States, Australia, all the English-speaking peoples. And I think that it's so important for us to network on this. When I say the people, I'm excluding the elites, of course, that are pushing these global agendas. I'm talking about the actual people, and it's important for us to network as much as we can, get this information out that we've got available, and to share it with each other. I think that's a good way to try and get back what we've lost. I don't know if you agree with that.
I do agree with that. I mean, really, it's a battle today, not between left wing and right wing, because the left wing and the right wing is being coordinated to the same end by an ideology. But the ordinary people in America and the ordinary people in England don't subscribe to that. The more they know, the more they're going to unite with each other, because it's about goodwill. It's about respecting each other, respecting our right to parent our children, respecting our right to use and enjoy our property, respecting our right to have a life that's our own. And the good people in England who are born out of the same tradition that Americans are, in terms of our culture and our law and our societal structure, just need to shake off the fog, compare notes with each other, become friends with those you thought weren't your friend, because we begin to recognize that ordinary people have common interests, and those common interests depend upon a societal structure that recognizes the importance of each individual and that guarantees a system of equal justice as opposed to a system of manipulated social justice. And you know, it's exciting for me to get to know you and other people. David Abbott is going to be at an Englishman, and the United Kingdom Independent Party is going to be at the Freedom 21 conference this July in Reno, Nevada. He's going to talk about the European Union and regionalization and some of these same issues that we've talked about tonight. But Robert, I want to thank you again very much for getting up early and sharing with us the dynamic from the other side of the ocean.
And I want everyone to keep writing to their local papers, Michael, and exposing these issues that we've been talking about.
Well, you are being great frontline action in England, and Americans need to do some of the same things. So we're going to keep in touch, and we're going to communicate back and forth and piggyback off each other and grow until there's a worldwide movement to restore and protect and preserve liberty.
Thank you very much, Michael, and all the best. We'll keep in touch.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank
Good night now.
Good night.